I'm sure you'd rather hear me speak than eat your dessert, so. Ruben's asked me to introduce what you're having for dessert, and it's Dooley's ice cream with pepper berry with a couple of leaves of mountain pepper. That's all he asked me to say, but I'm going to give you a bit of a geography, Latin and history lesson, because I didn't tell Ruben, but that's sort of what I do. Its Latin name is Tasmania lanceolata. That's why it gets the name lanceolata, right? Yeah, because of the leaf on your plate. Tasmania, where do you think it grows other than here? Van Diemen's Land. That's another name that can go to hell. Yes, it grows in Tasmania. So one thing that you may or may not have known, and if you didn't know it, then it's important that you do know it. It grows in Tasmania, and the local people, the Gadabunud, are likely to be Bass Coast people. They are, Gadabunud means speaking in the king parrot language, and it was a pejorative word that the local clans to the west of them used because it sounded like they were speaking a different tongue, which is most likely they were. They were speaking the land of the words of the Bass Coast. As the sea level rose, the Gadabunud people came north, and that's why they didn't interact as closely with the local tribes as others. So there you go, geography and history.
Gets loud again, I might introduce our last speakers. So we've heard from Kirsten already, and we're inviting her back to talk specifically about some of the things she's written about in her book, which are wild foods and foraging. And my very old dear friend Annie has also come down.
Old friend.
Annie and I lived together in a share house in our 20s in Melbourne. And in the last sort of six years, you've published a couple of fantastic books.
Yep.
The Weed Forager's Handbook, which I have given away so many copies of this book because it's so little and perfect and you can post it. But I can't seem to hang on to it for more than about a month every time I buy a copy. It's a fantastic book. Annie's doing an edible weeds walk at 10 o'clock tomorrow, starting at the community garden. I know some of the people here are booked in for it. It's going to be really interesting and enlightening. So two keen foragers. If you ladies would like to have a discussion about those things that you've both written about, that'd be wonderful.
Before we even get onto that, can I get someone to hold up the beer bottle in the middle of that table there? It says Prickly Moses on it. Spotted dog Prickly Moses. This is one of the reasons that it is so precious to be a gardener and someone that's involved in your local ecology, because I've been overseas for 6 months and I sat down and I saw that beer label there and I started crying because I was so happy to be back in Australia. And I see Prickly Moses written there, and that's not just a beer label. That's the plant that I planted next to all the fruit trees in my fruit yard to help nurse them through their young growth phase, because it's a legume and it fixes nitrogen into the soil and it helps to protect that young plant. And I know what it looks like where it grows along my local waterway in Melbourne, and I know how all the tiny little birds would come hide in its thistly little spiky branches because they're safe from predators when they're there, so they can come clean up insects in your garden. And that's the kind of thing that if you're not a gardener, you just see that beer bottle there. But your world becomes so much richer when you're involved in your ecology and when you're a gardener. So I just wanted to get started on that note and say how lucky everyone is here for that engagement in the world. Woo! Woo!
Yeah, we're just going to fiddle with our mics the whole time because we're like that. Yep. Now, Annie also has a second book which ties into this conversation quite perfectly, called The Art of Frugal Hedonism. Who's read this one? Yay! Yay. All right, I want you all to go home and read this, please. The Art of Frugal Hedonism is a guide to spending less while enjoying everything more. And it doesn't sound like it's purely about foraging, but it is sort of about foraging a new life for yourself by whatever means necessary and not only through weeds. So I think it ties in quite nicely yes. with what we're about to ramble about.
Well, I'd say it's about appreciating the lesser appreciated things that surround you that you might just be being blind to, which is definitely a way you could describe foraging.
Mm.
Because I have just been away for... It's been 6 months. I've been mostly in Scotland and in Portugal. I'm thinking about foraging through that lens a lot at the moment. And that yearning that Costa was talking about before and that you guys were just talking about, seeing that it's not a change that's going anywhere, of people having that craving to get more nature in their lives, it's not limited to Australia at all. I mean, it was incredible because everywhere that I went on this trip, I was finding out what the local weeds were that I could eat, and lots of them are the same as in Australia, because weeds are global. That's why they're weed is, because they're so successful and growing in lots of different conditions. But people throughout England and throughout Scotland and throughout Portugal would stop me when I was picking blackberries, just like they do here, and say, "Oh, can you eat those? I thought they were all sour and disgusting or something." And it happened everywhere that people weren't looking at you suspiciously for that, but they were looking with longing, like they wanted to know more, and they felt like you were doing something that they suddenly felt almost... You were engaging in a wealth that had been right in front of their eyes that they had been ignoring, and there was always that flicker of longing to get to join in on that wealth. And it is... We've just reached some cultural tipping point where people just... we're a bit undersupplied in something that we really need, and everyone's feeling it. It's not just the people in Apollo Bay, and it's not just the people in Melbourne planting out their verges with veggie gardens. It's pretty global, I think.
That's really interesting, because when I think about a lot of the introduced weeds to Australia that we know and love so much, I do sort of, I guess, assume that in their native habitat that they are more appreciated inherently by those populations because they're blackberries. But yeah, that's really interesting and obvious now that you say that. I'm like, of course it is. It's Western society.
Yeah.
It's disconnection from place. It's, the Western malady.
Yeah, I actually had assumed that there would be people walking along hedgerows in the UK with baskets in brambleberry season, filling those baskets. And it was just little Australian me. Like, there was nobody doing it. And I was watching people come out of the supermarkets with boxes of £1.99 Tesco's frozen blackberries in the middle of the peak of blackberry season. It seems like it's that knowledge has really dropped away a lot more than I would have expected.
Yeah, wow.
It's, and even when it hasn't dropped away, even when people would make those approaches to me and have this dawning look on their face of, oh, of course, I suppose I could be eating those too. It's that we are under the pressure of such a phenomenal and convincing machine of propaganda. And I'm not talking about Big Brother conspiracy stuff. It's just economics. It's what it has to do to meet its end. Mm. Is that there's a whole lot of people there working very hard who've done years of university to know how to make us change our behavioural patterns for certain money-making ends that have said the place you get food is from the shop. And so even if you know other ways, your brain goes, need food, go to shop. And it's really hard to avoid that message. And you have to consciously have counter arguments coming at you from some other direction, like from reading any of these three books or from talking to your local community garden. You've got to self-administer that other contradictory information about, oh, this is where you get food. Because, I mean, I've had people come up to me at talks and say, I love this book. I love this book. I've bought it for all my friends. And I said, which weeds are you eating the most? And they say, oh, well, I did use some dandelions when I first got it. And so I'm really curious. And I say, what isn't working then? What could I have done better in this book? And they said, no, it couldn't be better. And I say, so why is it that you're not using these as part of every meal? And they say, oh, I just forget when I go to make something that that's where food can come from, because none of my friends really do that. And so it has to be a group mentality
and
shift.
And about habits.
It has to be about habits.
What are your habits and what do you choose to... Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about forming habits and that as like the circuit breaker for a lot of different practices and thinking. If you can just form new habits and start with whatever it is that you've, like making yogurt or something extremely simple that is in your house anyway, and learning to make yogurt and not trying to do anything else weird, wacky, sustainable or otherwise until you've nailed yogurt. And once making yogurt is the most boringly normal thing that your entire family does, then you just do it, then you move to one more habit and you nail that and you move along and along. Or whether it's gathering, we don't buy greens, we only gather greens. And it's weird and wacky until you get the hang of it for some people. But once it's ingrained in your home culture, then it leads and it leads and it leads.
And that's why I think it was such a good choice for your book to keep it to those five chapters is because it's not overwhelming. It's people don't say, oh, look at all these things I need to do to feel good about where I'm getting my food from. It's like, I could just try these couple of enjoyable things and that's manageable.
What about the public space? Nick and I were talking before this evening started and talking about how the act of operating to gather your food in public space, whether it's even, you know, just down a gully, it's not particularly public, it's not in the middle of the park, or if you are in a hedgerow and you're the only one gathering blackberries, like, how did that feel in different countries where you're out of your normal comfort zone? You're pretty sure it's public space, which is part of the commons, which is part of all our work to reclaim those spaces and use them as they should be used and use the wild foods as they should be used. But was there an extra level of like, ooh?
Because definitely. Especially, I mean, my Portuguese is pretty broken. And to explain what you were doing, like there was who knows what mallow is here? Yeah. Congratulations. There's wonderful mallow in Portugal near the village where I was for most of the time. And to go out, I had to get a bit of chutzpah up to go out and be in public on the street from these little feral patches of grass, picking big bagfuls of mallow to make my dinner with. But at the same time, I know that this is a culture that has a history of foraging. It was a really rural area and people have been foraging there for ages. And I had to take that little bit of courage that if I was going to awake any strong sentiment in someone's bosom who was walking past me, that it was going to be nostalgia, not antagonism. And that turned out to be true. And people really did look the first several times, probably partly because I was half the age of everyone else in the village and I'm obviously a whitey foreigner. What am I doing eating the weeds? But the couple of conversations that I had with people about it were incredibly nostalgic and and I find that courage is always repaid. Like there's no one who has ever accosted me in a public place and
leave
said
those dandelions alone.
Yeah. put down that bit of plantain. That's my bit of plantain. That's probably about as close as it's ever come, as I think I was picking weeds on somebody's favourite patch for picking stuff to feed to their chickens, because he was a 100-year-old Greek man, said to me, no, it's for my chicken. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. But he was a bit upset, but that's the only time that's ever happened.
That's really interesting, because that's going to be my next question to you, is like, where are your personal limits of public space, and where do the commons meet private, you know, don't pick there from your perspective, because I know it's different for everyone.
You go first.
But maybe there's a little, you know, there's a little circle around that old guy's plantain, and the rest of it's still common. But
yeah,
that is, I mean, that's something that's quite interesting in terms of, it usually comes to more an overhanging fruit situation, which I actually think is as important to talk about as weeds, because the mentality that we're talking about here is not about whether you're eating garden produce or whether you're eating bush foods, whether it's mountain pepper or kale or whether it's dandelion or whether it's an apple that's spontaneously grown by the side of the road. The point is that we thrive best and we eat best and we use our landscape's potential for growth best when we are opportunistic about what we eat. It can't be, I feel like eating this or this recipe calls for this. It's that there's lots of apples and we learn how to make good things with apples. And that's, I mean, if there is so much fruit overhanging someone's property and you see that they're not picking it, then I feel quite comfortable, because for me at this point in our planet's history, I feel like making good use of a crop that's going to go to waste is more important than that, oh, but it's attached to a tree that's in that person's garden and they might be upset. Obviously, the best thing to do is knock on the door and ask first. But if you can clearly see that something's just been left in piles to rot on the ground, yeah, sure, I'll reach over a fence and pick a handful. The nicest thing to do in terms of extending that principle is to knock on that door and say, I'm going to make something with these if you're not going to use them, and I'm going to bring you some. And would you like me to tell you how you can help, how you can preserve these apples so they don't go to waste or whatever? And so often when I've done that, people are just, oh no, I always feel guilty that I should get around to using them, but I just forget. Again, it's that I forget that it's there. And that's, it's a wonderful thing to be a gardener, but we have to actually look at the food that we're producing in our systems. Use the carrot tops, cook the broccoli stalk. Like, that's where all the really interesting food comes from. And I think there's a quote that, it was in this book, that where we're talking about how you end up with almost more gourmet food from cooking with random self-suggesting opportunistic produce, is that, you know, Italian peasant X didn't say, I'm going to make verjuice so that in 100 years Maggie Beer can put it in little bottles and sell it for $7.99 to people that want some authentic Italian cuisine. They went, I'm going to make some verjuice because I need something acidic to go with my food, and I've got underripe grapes, and I know from having eaten them when they're underripe that they're a bit tart. And I don't have any lemons ripe at the moment, so I'll use some of these underripe grapes to add a bit of acidity to my food. And that's what you come up with when you use all the stuff and you eat opportunistically, is you come up with the really tasty stuff. So it's a win-win in that way. Costa, were you waving here?
Yeah, but, you know, what if, this fruit you're talking about falls on the street and someone could slip on it like an onion?
It's actually a public service to pick it before
exactly,
it falls.
Exactly, yeah.
So it doesn't, you know, roll underneath their fence and back out to the street.
And imagine how terrible it would be if councils allowed fruit trees and nut trees to be planted in parks sometimes so everyone could go harvest them, and then people would just be falling over and killing themselves all the time. Maybe walnuts would fall on someone's head at just the wrong angle and they'd get lobotomized. It just wouldn't be worth the risk, having people come together in big, excitable groups into the public park for an almond picking session or something, and all taking some almonds home and feeling really great about community and life and having some free local food. But yeah, it'd be awful.
Thanks, Costa.
Yeah, thanks. question for you.
Okay.
The seaweed, mm-hmm. I have to say I'm particularly excited and intrigued. I know that for me, and for basically anyone I've ever taught about picking wild greens, that when you learn about wild foods, and I actually just like to say wild foods in general, because weeds are just some of the most common
of the wild foods that you can pick. That's the reason that I focus on those. That when you learn about that stuff, almost everyone's first comment is, oh, everything looks different. It just, like, it was just all green stuff before. And now it's just, there's so much information and there's so many things to use everywhere. Do you feel that way? Because I've only used a little bit of seaweed. Do you feel that way at all after having learnt about seaweeds to eat?
Yeah, although seaweeds are sort of an extra level of excitement in Australia. In Australia, there are no seaweeds that can kill you. Yay! There's one or two red ones on the West Coast that are toxic if consumed in large quantities on a daily basis for over 20 years, according to the seaweed scientist I met in Tasmania. Anyway, sorry, Nick, it's fine. Anyway, so it's like this whole world of wild foods that you can't even die
it's
from.
It's free-for-all.
I know. So it's pretty exciting. And, yes, it does completely change how you see the beach in the same way that, once you've got your green weeds down, you're like, ooh. And seaweeds are exactly the same, although they, you know, with the beach cast seaweed, there was obviously the fresh stuff that still looks really great. And then there's the stuff further up the beach, which is decomposing and performing all these really incredibly important ecosystem services that doesn't look as delicious. I was down the beach today and actually the bull kelp that's right up at the high tide mark, it looks almost like entrails. It's incredible.
You don't realise that you're not supposed to take it from the beach because the parks, it's illegal down in Victoria. New South Wales, I think you can take it.
In Victoria, unless you're in a marine reserve, from the information I've been given from the Victorian authorities, no? The information I've been given from talking to four different people at fisheries and parks has been, on average, that you can take a couple of shopping bags of beach cast per day, which is obviously a very empirical measurement, a couple of shopping bags.
You know that because you weren't allowed to take any seaweed to put on your garden on the beach.
Which beach is that, by the way?
This one in front of us.
Okay, cool. And in some places in Victoria, it is council mandated, so the Hobson's Bay. In Hobson's Bay Council in Port Phillip, you can take as much as you like because they're trying to get rid of it. They're scraping up for landfill, so that council has a separate mandate. It's probably too strong a word, but they encourage people to harvest as much as they want. It's pretty crazy. But, yes, and then in New South Wales, you can take up to 20 litres or kilos a day.
Yay.
And that's then in Tasmania, you can take 100 kilos a day. And this is all, of course, within, as with weeds, as with any wild harvesting, it's in the context of what's appropriate and, you know, what's there. And you don't just take everything you can find. But, And it also indicates a really big gap in our cultural understanding and the current reality in Australia, that because the laws are so fuzzy around seaweed collecting for the most part, partly because we don't see it as a wild food resource or, you know, a fertility resource, there's this real blind spot there. So there isn't a whole lot of clarification. I've spent the last 2 or 3 years trying to get straight answers out of fisheries departments, and everyone I talk to goes, oh, I don't know, oh, no, it's all right. And it's been quite fraught trying to get a straight answer about this incredibly nutritious, amazing resource that is all around 97% of the Australian population.
Which, I mean, it's frustrating for you.
It's crazy.
But the fact that there's someone calling up and asking that question then means that they need to start shifting their thinking so they think about that as a food resource and figure out what the answer is that makes sense to give people. So that's useful in just like asking the question is useful.
Lobbying. I mean,
it's the same thing as one advice that I would always give anyone on a weeds walk is to check with your local council or wherever you're foraging if they have a policy to say you have to put signs up saying these weeds have been sprayed and how long does that sign leg you have to stay up for, and does your council have a mandate that you use
dye in the herbicide so that people can visibly see that way if something's been sprayed. And you call some council, when I was trying to figure out how consistent that was, calling various councils around the metropolitan area, many of them don't even know how to answer the question because...
the what?
Yeah. But just by asking the question, they then have to think, right, there's people out there using this as a food source. We better have a policy on this, which is... We're at least at a point in history now where it feels like you're within your right to ask that question and say that it needs to be something you can know, whereas there might have been a kind of nasty period a couple of decades ago where someone would have said, oh, well, you shouldn't be picking it anyway. But now, because there's a bit of a love affair going on with reclaiming... food sovereignty in so many ways, councils are much more inclined to say, oh yes, we really should have a policy on that, and I suppose there are people out there eating those blackberries, and even that's a really positive shift by itself, so, and asking the question.
Like, that is a fantastic segue.
Yes.
Into asking some questions as we wrap
up. Asking questions is wonderful. That's just where I was going, Ms. Lawson. Yeah.
When you describe the beach, it almost sounds like the old-fashioned commons to some sense. And I wonder what you think is the link between the loss of the commons and the loss in our culture of growing food and foraging, etc. And is that part of the answer, that councils and the like start using parks and what have you to start returning some sort of common food production available to
it? I think we both think a lot of things on that particular...
Many things, yeah. Well, I was immediately going to say you should talk a bit about David's work along the creek, well, and you guys now too, changing that into a commons managed landscape. That's a slightly different kind of commons. Do you want to describe that a bit?
I think we'd probably all agree that we have been over-regulated in the last generation, at least when it comes to where public land interacts with our communities and with our own psyches. We have lost to a great degree that connection to the gullies around our town and to the beaches. Is this our beach? Is this someone else's beach? Do I need to ask permission? I don't know. There's a big conversation there. Where we live in Daresford, there is a gully down the back of the property. We've lived there for 2 years, and David Holmgren and his partner Sue Dennett have been managing the property for 35 years, and they took it upon themselves to reclaim the entire gully, which does not belong to the property technically. It's a fire risk. It had a lot of, you know, weed species and eucalypt overstory, and they've taken it on themselves for the last 35 years to turn it into what they call the Spring Creek Community Forest. And they've done a huge amount of bushfire mitigation with animals, with, you know, workshops. They've planted a whole lot of other species. They've encouraged more and more food plants in there. The entire system, it's one of those beautiful examples where the entire gully system is now used by lots of people for walking dogs and, you know, grazing cows occasionally and all sorts of crazy things, as it was once upon a time when it was a commons by default. But it's part of their give back to their community to manage this system in a way that makes it extremely useful for everyone. I don't think very many families know or even care, perhaps, that this work has been done. And it also has, you know, there's a self-interest there too. It's in the fire sector of this property, and it prevents the bushfire from roaring up that particular gully, you know, pushed by the predominant wind of the area. So, you know, it's a bit of a win-win. But I grew up on the beach with a little reserve in front of our house that my family took it upon themselves to plant hundreds and hundreds of trees and restore the dunes, and because it, you know, it was where we lived. And I think there's such a big conversation there, but it comes back to, you know, getting on with it and asking forgiveness rather than permission if it is within a landscape or a land space that you feel it's the right thing to do to either restore or even just interact with it as part of where you live, I think, go for
it. In the less guerrilla and more formal context too,
I've had it pointed out to me recently that this is, well, almost just like I was talking about with asking the questions and there not being a clear policy on seaweed collection, for example, or weed spraying. This is a very open space at this point. And so it's kind of like we're kind of in a sweet spot because councils, I've had friends who work connected to council, they think councils are so open to any proposals in this sphere at this point. Go, if you get enough people together in your local neighbourhood and say, no, we really think that the local park should be mowed by goats instead, and we've got, you know, a group of people who are prepared to nominate themselves as owners of those goats, and they'll lease the goat to you for, and you'll have a contract, and it will be less than the cost of the mowing bill for the year, and they get to milk that goat. And they said they'll if you put it together well enough, councils are really prone to go for that kind of thing at this point in time, because they're like, yeah, we've got funding for this kind of thing. We're supposed to be doing these things and bring the proposals to them about public plantings and about mowing the park with goats and about creating known seaweed foraging quotas, and it can turn into a thing that you did.
I should thank our major sponsor, Collacott Wayshire. Thank you. Thank you, ladies. Hey, that was fantastic. Thanks so much. I'd like to thank all of our speakers. Annie and Kirsten have been wonderful. Nick, Costa, Dav and Jack. Thanks so much for coming along tonight. Thanks again to Liz, Jody, Reuben and Grape, who have all worked so hard to put the food and the lovely wines together tonight. Woo! Fantastic job. And I hope I see everyone at the community garden or one of the open gardens over the next 2 days. There's such a big program. We've got some really, really wonderful gardens to go and visit and some workshops and some tours. So I'll see you all there. Thank you so much for coming. Thanks, Phil, the sound guy. Yay! Can't believe I almost forgot.